Okay, before we get into the Q&A again, Professor Rabuteau wanted to make a comment on the previous question.
Actually, it was a comment on a comment that was made to me while I was having coffee. The question was he asked was, what's your father's name, which I forgot to mention. My father's name is my name. His name is Albert Jordy Rabuteau, so I'm actually Albert Jordy Rabuteau Jr., or the second, as I prefer. And I have a son whose name is Albert Jordy Rabuteau the third, and he has a son who is Albert Jordy Rabuteau the fourth. So the line, such as it is, goes on.
Yes. Okay, David Rennie, you're first. Bring the microphone up. And then after David Knapp and Lauren Green and Julia and Carl and Elizabeth. So anyway, go ahead, David.
Thank you very much. It's the first talk I've been to ever that I wish my kids could be here to hear it. So for what that's worth.
We'll invite them next time.
don't do that. The question I wanted to ask slightly overlaps with some of my colleagues, and it's about how moral jujitsu and shaming of a kind of hegemonic kind of majority culture, how that works now. I mean, clearly, in one kind of crude political sense, Charleston worked because the extraordinary goodness of the church got the flag down incredibly fast. It clearly just sort of moved a logjam. But in general, are there potential risks to a narrative about how the good response is forgiveness now? Because in the past, when you had either slavery or legal segregation, it was goodness as a response to a kind of system which denied that it was bad, and so there was a kind of shaming. The moral jujitsu worked around shaming in that context. Now, the dominant narrative from those who do not wish to hear about Black Lives Matter or black suffering is that this country was bad, sure, we accept that, but now we're colorblind, we want to move on, we don't want to hear about this anymore. So I wanted to ask you, possibly clumsily, how does that moral jujitsu work in exactly the same way now in this new context where there's a risk that people just co-opt it and say, you see, yes, exactly, you've forgiven us because you accept that this was an isolated incident with no larger political significance, that, you know, Dylann Roof was insane and their forgiveness has, you know, allowed us to park it. Is there a sense that the moral jujitsu works differently now, that the struggle is to deny that things are normal?
A very good question, and I think my answer to it would go back to something I said at the end before with the break, is that if there can be an opening made by horrendous incidents like the one in Charleston, for which, you know, frankly, and as a religious person, you know, there is a irrationality to evil. There is a sense in which there's something inexplicable about something like that happening. And forgiveness isn't the only, is not an adequate answer to something like that. I mean, we're also thrust back into the book of Job by events that occur. But if what comes out of it is what I referred to earlier as face-to-face talk, communication, that my hope for change lies in communication. And we're talking about a micro level, nothing against macro level either, but I think we need to not be strangers to each other and to each other's experiences. And the more that we can become less estranged, the more there's a possibility of change. It's hard to hate somebody who you eat with regularly. And it's important to discover beyond the binary of racism. I mean, for us, what racism means is black and white. Well, racism can mean a lot of other things, too, that, as we know, as our variety of immigration continues. So there's this always continuing exfoliation of stories from different people, from different backgrounds. And if we can, on the smaller levels, begin to share those stories and see the suffering and triumph, the sadness, the joy of other people, we can begin to see them, and I'm going to use some purposely religious language here, we begin to see them not as others, but we can begin to see them as icons of God's presence, as made in the likeness and image of God.
David has a quick follow-up.
Just to check that I've understood right, are you saying in some sense that the power of what happened in Charleston was that their extraordinary reaction, the whole of America saw actually, wow, not just to these kind of other people who are very good, they realized that these people are more American than the killer, that they're more like us than the killer is. The killer is the alien.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, Nap Nasworth and then Lauren Green. Over here.
You talked about the history and that the split within Christianity, you said, was deep and fundamental when you had two versions of Christianity, some who supported slavery, some who did not support slavery. Then in response to Emma's question about what this means for religious institutions, you said what we need to bind us together is to hear the stories of others in face-to-face contact. And, you know, we've seen a tremendous growth of multiracial, multi-ethnic churches in the United States. And so I wonder what you think about what it means for the future of the church. If we are going to repair that split, does the church need to become more multiracial, multi-ethnic? And if so, what does this mean for those historically black churches that grew out of the slave churches?
Future questions, I often use the ready excuse that I'm a historian, and actually knowing history does not prepare you for knowing the future. But I'll try to come up with some fuzzy answer to your... It's a good question. I mean, one of the questions was formed for Howard Thurman, who was a major ecumenical figure, who was a chaplain at... Howard, and then was co-pastor of the first interracial church in the country, the Church for the Unity of All People, founded in San Francisco with a white Presbyterian minister. He was Black Baptist in the background. And the question for Thurman became, well, logically, doesn't your position mean the disappearance of the black church? And he talks about this in a book called Footsteps of the Dream. And basically he says, yes, theoretically, but we have a long way to go in terms of something like that happening. And it doesn't necessarily mean the disappearance of the church, but the changing of how we think of churches. That is there something sacrosanct about denominational lines? Is there something sacrosanct about, for example, as in the Church for All Peoples, you have a mixture not just of ethnicities, but you actually have a mixture of faiths. It's an interfaith church. So what some future dimensions may be, right now, as far as I can see, as a functional possibility, is for churches to become places where these kinds of discussions, interfaith discussions, and interracial and interethnic discussions can go on. Trying to stress basically what the church believes, which is, if at least it's Christian, is the universality of Christianity. Mm-hmm.
So, okay.
That's the answer I would give.
Okay, Lauren Green, over here on the left.
I know you're not a theologian, but I think this is kind of on a sort of philosophical level. The beginning of your talk, you quoted Scripture, the Lord's Prayer, which is, forgive us our trespasses, or forgive us our debts, forgive us our sins as we forgive others. And I see this sort of an intellectual level of forgiveness, but then you went on and really explained the reality of forgiveness that is on a visceral level, that's not intellectual at all. How do you bring these two concepts of forgiveness together?
Yes, the rub of it is the question of how does one take, in this particular case, the gospel sayings of Jesus. One is, how do you pray? So he says, this is how you pray, and that results in the Our Father. Crucial part of the Our Father is that particular, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass others. That is a prescription of how to live. It's not just an intellectual formation. It's a teaching about this is how you pray, but your prayer should be your life. Mm. The second quote, which is, I'm tired, which is...
Matthew 5, 43 and 44.
Yeah, which is, this is the Sermon on the Mount.
Yeah.
And this is, he's saying, you have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. This is the old law. I'm giving you a new law. So the Sermon on the Mount is a new Ten Commandments. So this is not, again, it's not intellectual. This is a commandment. You know, I'm sorry, folks, but loving your neighbor and hating your enemy isn't going to do it anymore. That's not sufficient. The new commandment is, if you're going to be Christians, is you've got to love your enemies, et cetera, bless those who curse you and do good to those who hate you. Now, the last one is a different category altogether, which is his, that is Jesus' enactment of these two commandments. This is what I've said you should do in your daily prayer, in your daily life, and this is what I've said you're supposed to do generally. Here's an example of me doing it. So this is an instruction manual that's being presented here for living.
Okay, Julia, you're up next. Pull the mic over. Eugene, you just raise your hand.
Yes.
Yeah, gotcha.
Thanks again for your talk. My question is...
Princeton alum. Yay.
Princeton alum?
Princeton alum.
My question is kind of more historical about this dialogue around forgiveness and Christianity to the extent that it was imposed on Black people when they were brought over as slaves, and to some extent used as a tool of enslavement, and the kind of the backlash to Christianity, to this narrative of forgiveness that arose within the Black community in the 60s and 70s, you know, with Stokely Carmichael and Nation of Islam and stuff. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that and how you see that debate.
The answer is that that debate caused me to go to graduate school at Yale and to write a dissertation on slaves. And the book that resulted from that dissertation is called Slave Religion. Hmm. And the short answer is the last chapter of that book is called Religion, Rebellion, and Docility. Rebellion, and Docility. And what I basically argue is that rebellion and docility were not the only two alternatives, that there's another alternative which involves symbolic resistance, to know that you are morally superior, to know that you are not a nigger or a slave, but a human being, a child, not just a human being, but a child of God. Especially when linked to the evangelical requirement of a conversion experience. These are people who have experienced God's total acceptance of them as his children, viscerally have had that experience. And that changes the whole way in which you see life. Having experienced that, they talk about, I felt new. My feet felt new. My hands felt new. I loved everybody and everything. I went and hugged a tree. Now, the thing about that conversion experience is that's the grammar of faith for white Protestants in the South as well. One quick incident, now we can move on. A slave named Mort's out in the fields, and he has a seizure. He has a conversion experience, and he gets back to the barn where the owner's waiting for him. He says, "Where were you?" And he tells him his conversion experience. The master begins to cry, and he says, "Mort, I see you're a preacher. I want you to preach before my house on Sunday." Mort stands up before the big house on a makeshift kind of platform. He preaches to the master, and he says, "I reduce the master and the master's family to tears, and the rest of the people who are around." Now, presumably, the slaves are watching this. What does it mean to see a fellow slave reducing the master and his family and others to tears by preaching on their enslavement to sin?
Slaves at the end, right?
Sure.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. But then, you know, at the end of the day, they're still slaves.
That's right. But it's not that that's their only reality. They're not only slaves. They are children of God with spiritual power. And don't forget Exodus. Their enslavement, if not theirs, their children's, is going to end because God intervenes in human history to cast down the mighty and lift up the lowly.
Thank you.
Carl, you're up next. Pull the mic over, please. And then Elizabeth.
Professor, I wanted to talk about something you mentioned a couple times, and you just were covering there, and when you said how often do people have meals with people of a different race on a regular basis, and that got me back to thinking about Emmanuel Church in Charleston. When the Sunday after the shootings, the congregants at another church, Citadel Square Baptist Church, came to church there. The names of the nine names that you named were in their program. Those churches are right next to each other. There's this white church and this black church. And even before the shooting, the pastors had been talking about doing things, but they'd never quite gotten around to it, you know, with the two congregations. And it was 10 years ago that the Southern Baptist Convention issued its resolution on racial reconciliation, acknowledging the Southern Baptist Church's hand in Jim Crow and slavery, and it's passed, and said it would do more to support civil rights. And having those names in the pew there, and the people went over from one church, from the white church to the other church, and brought flowers. It was a very touching scene. The networks were there. The New York Times wrote about it. There was a guy with the perfect Christian name, Willie Glee, who greeted the white parishioners and said, "You've been good neighbors." And it was a good feeling all the way around. But I'm wondering, hearing you talk, if it's enough. And I would ask if you, it's a little out of your area, but obviously you've thought about this. What could these churches do more to actually have real integration? And would that help?
Yes. I mean, I think what they can do more is basically what the gospel requires. That is, they could probably do more. I don't know what they're doing now, so that's why I'm saying probably. They could probably do more about schooling in Charleston for poor children. They could possibly do more in their area for the homeless. They could possibly do more in their area for the environment. They could possibly do more. Basically, I'll just say, they could do what Pope Francis says. Yes.
Yeah. Is there a practical good to having them worship together is what I'm getting at. These two churches are right beside each other, and really they're segregated. There's no, it's not like you wrote in your first book, you can go into communion in one church, they'll serve it to you. It's not like it's anything, but people, they don't.
Before you answer that question, Maya was spent a month in Charleston for Time Magazine. Do you want to comment on this point that Carl's raising? Do you know about this part? And grab the microphone, please.
I wasn't there immediately after, but when I went down in August, we started by going to Bible study on a Wednesday, and there had become this new Emmanuel, I guess you could say. It's not necessarily new. It's just completely different than what it was like, from my understanding, prior to the shooting, because it's a very diverse group of people, people from the Charleston community who had never worshipped an Emmanuel, people from all over who wanted to just simply pray with the parishioners there, because like you mentioned, noted before, when people saw this moment of forgiveness, they began to see people of that church, people of Charleston, not as strangers, but as, you know, children of God. They saw themselves in the community there, and they wanted to pray with them. And I think it goes back to this idea of this moment having greater power than we could really understand. It helped people see that, though they had been neighbors all along, they didn't really know each other, and they wanted to better understand. And maybe had that happened before, you know, maybe the shooting wouldn't have happened. I mean, that's a different topic, but like, it's just a different way of understanding how to foster communication and understanding within communities. I don't know if that answered it at all, but.
No, that's very helpful, Professor.
In terms of worshiping together, yes, there are ways of doing that. That, in terms of having a service on alternate Sundays, where you might do that, or having a prayer service, or having a Bible study, in which you have both congregations, you know, welcome to participate together. I would choose the Bible study as the first way to go.
I'm sorry, say that again.
The first thing I would suggest for them is to have a mixed congregation Bible study.
Yeah. Okay, Elizabeth Diaz is next, and then Ted Davis and Eugene and Daniel.
Thank you so much, Professor. As a Princeton Seminary alum, not the university, but the seminary, I appreciated your sharing the story of the Grimke family. I'm curious, you mentioned the two national myths of what America means for the Black community and the white community, specifically in churches. I'm curious, as a third national myth has really been rising in past decades with the growth of the Latino community, just demographically, and the different Christian faith tradition that brings. As a historian, how do you define or describe the Latino history about forgiveness, and where do you see that intersect this conversation historically? And, you know, I'm just really curious what's been fruitful about that, what's been challenging.
That's a good question. And I have taught courses, not in a while, but I've taught courses on Roman Catholicism in America. And the Latino explosion in the population is extremely significant in terms of that. I'm not sure of any particular let me backtrack on that. What I would say is that the wedge of Latinos, and it comes after some attempts by Black Catholics, which is a very small part of the population in Catholicism or among Black people, it's a minority within a minority, comes on the wake of trying to take advantage of what the Catholic Church has adopted as a pastoral policy. In a short one word, that policy is enculturation. So the impact of Latinos is to extend the notion of enculturation, which the Church in America has been dealing with ever since the early days, with the Germans coming in, trying to replace the French-influenced Anglo, and the Irish coming in, tension with the Germans, and then the Polish and others coming in, and then the Italians coming in and being downgraded by the Irish. There's been this constant tendency as new immigrant groups have come to say, well, what kind of Catholicism will they be part of? and the attempts in the 20th century are for the church to adopt the policy, you don't have to be a German Catholic, you don't have to be an Irish Catholic, you can be enculturated. So a wonderful book on this for Italians is Robert Orsi's Madonna of 115th Street. For African Americans, it's become the pattern for the establishment of black Catholic parishes, in which ironically what they celebrate are gospel masses, which some black Catholics have problems with. But the idea of trying to live what Catholicism preaches, which is universality. But the lesson of America, American Catholic understanding of universality is not an abstract quality. If you make it an abstract quality, what it means is the hegemony of the majority. But universality, to be truly universal, has to be universal in a particular way. So the particularity of Latino spirituality, Our Lady of Guadalupe, the Christmas pageants, celebration of the Day of the Dead, a lot of other practices, have to be embraced by the larger Catholic structures as appropriate and necessary. So universality as a reality in terms of there's no culture in which can't be enculturated into the body of Christ equally as valid. I'm not sure that answers your question, but I think that's what the Latino community
okay. Forerunners. I'm about to call on Ted Davis, and let me just say to John Carr and Arthur Brooks, you're both welcome also to get in, let me know if you want to get in. I'll call on you. Ted Davis, you're up next, and then Eugene Scott.
Thank you very much, Professor, for that.
Turn that on, please.
Thank you very much, Professor, for that amazing talk. I would really like to be one of your students sometime. I'd like to ask something more academic, if I could, since I'm not a journalist, but come back to Lauren Green's question and kind of reverse it. I want to ask about the formal theological roots of Martin Luther King's approach. I want to pick up on a comment he made in which he said the metaphysical, and he was describing Boston University School of Theology specifically, gave him the metaphysical and philosophical grounding for the idea of a personal God. That's what King said. And apparently this was a reference to Edgar Brightman and his work at Boston University. Brightman wrote to quote Brightman, all religion is of, by, and for persons. Religion ascribes a unique value to persons and has a unique interest in their welfare and their salvation. That's from Brightman's essay, Religion as Truth. I wanted your take on that and see if that has anything to do with the degree to which the civil rights movement in America may have been rooted in specific kinds of Christian theology.
Yes, I mean, three comments. One is that the movement made King. King didn't make the movement. So King is certainly one of the most eloquent spokesmen for the civil rights movement, but his philosophy and his ideas were not necessarily constitutive of what it meant to be involved in that movement. There's been a strong movement to, a strong tendency now to say, backtrack a bit. The last person in my book that I mentioned earlier, King is certainly in the book, but the last person in my book is Fannie Lou Hamer. Because Hamer is not part of the clerical elite of the SCLC. Hamer speaks for the people, the sharecroppers, the poor, and she doesn't come out of a Brightman tradition. And she didn't need to realize that God is personal, and that persons are of utmost importance in Christianity. So it's good to know King's intellectual background, but a lot of that is irrelevant to the people in the movement. The values are relevant, but the background is not necessarily. Secondly, King was influenced a great deal by the Fellowship of Reconciliation through the person of A.J. Mustey, and Bayard Rustin. And Musty writes a tract in 1943 on the meaning of the Bible. And in it he says, if Jim Crow was ever to be conquered in the United States, it will be through the efforts of the Negro church and its white friends. And it's going to involve suffering. But as everyone knows, redemptive suffering releases the divine power into human history. Concept that, you know, resonates totally with King. But it came from A.J. Musty, through Bayard Rustin, through Rustin, who taught King what nonviolence was about. So he has multiple sources, including the social gospel tradition of his own father and grandfather at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta.
Okay, Eugene Scott and then Daniel. Both of you are there, so share the mic. But first, you're up, Eugene, over here.
Thank you for your time. You spoke earlier about the hope of historically black and predominantly white churches coming together to address race issues here in the States and hopefully having an impact on it beyond the church. So wondering, what do you make of all of the data saying that fewer people are actually even going to church, especially among millennials, the increasing number of unaffiliated people? The nuns would suggest that the impact of the church on this issue can't be as significant as it has been historically.
That may be the case, but one of the things I would say is that possibly activism might be one of the ways of bringing nuns back to the church. Mm. That they don't have anything, the church doesn't offer them anything that's meaningful. And it's not just racism, it's poverty. It's inequality of wealth, it's greed, it's a society that's devoted to entertainment and acquisition. There's lots to criticize in our society today. And if churches were involved in some of that criticism in meaningful ways, it might help to bring some people back to the church who might be idealistic and looking for a meaningful contribution to life that they're not finding within the church.
Okay, Daniel, you're up next. There's the microphone.
I was wondering about, so jumping off Eugene's question, where are the places in our society where you can encourage people to not be strangers and to, you know, actually get dinner with people of other races and ethnicities? Like, colleges used to be more places where there'd be more moral instruction, and that's not the case in many places. Should the government be involved at all, or how, like, where do you tell this message to millions of people, you know, that would help change their hearts and make them not be strangers?
Government is certainly not the answer. it has to begin on a local level. And I spoke to a group of high school students about a year ago who were involved in a school program that bring high school students to Princeton's campus and tries to give them some intellectual stimulation beyond their high school classes. And one of the things that I suggested is I talked to them about Thurman and his ideas, and I talked to them about some of Jonathan Kozol's writing, Savage Inequalities, Holy Resurrection, Ordinary Grace. If you haven't read those books, read them. I'll be a teacher here for a minute. there won't be a test. It's important because for these students, I asked them, how many of you go to school with other races? You know, and it was true that there's a lot of, there's just not opportunity for them to get together. Mm-hmm. So I suggested that this organization be such a place. And it was appropriate because the group was quite well racially integrated. So you start with small groups in which you try to get people basically where they are and say, this is an important thing that we need to develop for citizenship. It's an important thing we need to do to change a society that's still damaged by segregation. And you start small and build and see where it goes. And I don't think it's that difficult. I mean, we have all kinds of Rotary clubs. We've got chambers of commerce. We've got various organizations. It shouldn't be that hard for a few people to organize, whether they're from a seminary or from a college local people who are civically minded to create organizations. If you can create all the Martin Luther King Day celebrations that we have, why can't you form out of those some groups that are willing to have other meetings on other days than his birthday?
What comes to mind is a lot of people, they don't even realize what they're missing. They don't even think. They're well-meaning people. They're not racist, but they're leading such busy lives that they don't think, you know, about this, you know, about this issue. They don't think, oh, I should get to know people other than who look like me. So yeah. You have to point that out to them.
Yeah, one of the ways of doing it, I've alluded to already, is it's the job of the press. That is by saying, look, all of this has been happening in Charleston. You know, here's a magazine, a Time magazine. I don't have my copy here, that talks about this. Let's read this article in Time and talk about it.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and have you know, it takes several meetings to talk about it. Or book groups. Book groups are great places to raise such issues. Have them read The Color of Water by James McBride, or Woman Warrior, about the art. The Little Rock, Arkansas, Seven, and reading those books, really explode people's consciousness about such matters.
Doyle McManus, you're up next, and then Julia, and then John.
Professor, thank you. This has been wonderful.
Speaking, where are you?
I'm here. This has been challenging and enlightening and really quite wonderful. I want to take you back to the starting point of your dissertation, in a sense, the recurring debate within the civil rights movement about whether there is a tension between the rage for justice and the idea of forgiveness, and try, as a journalist, to vault you into the present day and ask, are you hearing any echoes of that debate in Black Lives Matter, in the discussions, the struggle of that movement to figure out how to frame its message?
I haven't read as much as I should about Black Lives Matter. I've seen television and radio and read headlines about it. But in terms of debates, I'm not aware of any that deal with the role of religion or the Black church. So I really am not competent to answer that question. It'd be interesting if there aren't. It'd be interesting to know what their relationship of that movement is, if any, to Black churches. And some of you may know.
Julia?
We've been talking a lot about different communities interacting with each other, and we talked about this a little bit privately, but as I mentioned, I went to Jewish day schools in Baltimore, and I remember every February leaders from the Black religious community would come in and talk to us about Black history and stuff, and you know, the Jewish community and the Black community were often in lockstep during the civil rights movement. And since then, it seems that on both sides, that relationship has frayed, to put it mildly. And there seems to be a lot of animosity on both sides. And I was wondering what the history of that is, and how, and then the second question is, how the two communities can, that I think have such a natural historical affinity for each other and under, like, empathy in a way that I think not every community can have for each other. Where can the two communities go from here in bridging what has become a pretty nasty divide?
Yeah. Well, the origins of it, I think, go back to one word, quotas, that Jews were the subject of quotas in terms of admission to colleges like Harvard and Princeton and elsewhere. And so the whole issue of affirmative action for Jews took on a different content and implication than it did for African Americans. And then that played itself out also in various school districts, particularly in boroughs of New York, about control, local control of schools. And it did become very ugly. You're right about the fact that it's there's so much in common. And I was mentioning that in Slave Religion, I talk about a guy named a Union chaplain named W.J. Kephart, who came south after the war, and he was talking to the freedmen about their religion, and he said, "These people are used to thinking of Moses as their savior rather than Jesus Christ, you know, because the story that they preferred was the story of Exodus." And while that was, he was overstating the case to some extent, he was certainly right in that it's the certainly the Jewish scriptures and Exodus and the prophets of the mid-8th century that have been crucial in African-American religious preaching and piety. So there is a closeness there. Again, I hate to belabor what I've said before, but I think the best way for there to be communication beyond the occasional sharing of a Seder with Black Americans or other Americans is small group discussions and discussions that are not just, you know, let's just sit here and make nice, but let's talk about problems. And let's see if there's something concretely that we can do about some of these problems. So the guide here is that we have such a flat and poor understanding of what the political body means. When we think about politics, we think often about governing and election. We don't think about civic discourse and about how we should be training our children from an early age to be aware of civic responsibility and of civic discourse in which differences are not ignored as potentially conflictual, but differences are celebrated as what is the case in our polity, in our body politic. And if you start out them out as children, then maybe the nature of political discourse will change into something that's much more humane than it presently is, which is a battle of tit for tat between the left and the right.
Okay, John Carr, you're up over here on the left.
Thank you very much for your moving analysis and testimony on the power of evil and the power of faith. My question is a very specific one. I'm now at Georgetown University. Georgetown converted the Jesuit residence into a special dormitory for students. It was named after an early leader of the Jesuit community. And in the process of renaming and dedicating this building, came to light that this Jesuit, at a crucial moment in the history of Georgetown, sold the slaves that belonged to the Jesuits. This has made the issues we're talking about really immediate. And the question of what to name the building, commissions. We now have a new form of a sit-in at the president's office. It's from 9 to 5. Only Georgetown would figure out how to do business hours for a sit-in. But my question would be, given your own history, given your deep belief, how should a religious academic community seize this moment to remind us of where we've been and what we ought to do about that history?
Well, the first thing would be to acknowledge that the Jesuits have owned slaves from the start of their presence in the U.S. Second is that there probably is already a Healy Hall, but Healy was an African American. So there are also figures who were priests in the United States who were black, although they were very light blacks.
That's where we commented.
Something can be made out of that history if it hasn't already been made. And the other thing I would say is that the Jesuits have an extensive history of writing about social justice, in this country. And some of the earlier books on actually African-American Catholics were written by Jesuits. So there's a tradition of concern as well as of oppression that perhaps needs to be lifted up here. Now, that may not answer the students' difficulties, but meeting with them and talking candidly about this, I think, is necessary. And then I would also show them the film, The Mission, which I think movies sometimes can be great for moving things along. Show them The Mission and see how they respond to that, and talk about the Jesuit reductions and what the Jesuit reductions were like in Latin America.
Tom, you got a microphone there?
So there have been a lot of questions asked.
Don't call me sir, please.
Can I call you professor?
Makes me think of Sidney Poitier.
You have touched on many issues, and my question, you've already answered my question in little ways at various moments, but it has to do with clarifying your thoughts on the role of the government and versus the role of faith-based organizations in working for justice, because I've heard you've told different stories. One is the empowerment that comes from faith and how important that has been, but on the other hand, you told the story of Fannie Lou Hamer. You emphasize the story of Fannie Lou Hamer, who seems to have come from a more secular experience and sort of focused on sort of more secular approaches. And this is obviously a huge issue right now, whether the work for justice is the mission of government or whether it's the mission of faith-based organizations. This
next session is on that question.
Let's get Professor Rabobo's view on that.
Well, I'll take that as an out, but one of the things I want to say is that you're wrong about Fannie Lou Hamer. She was converted, literally converted. Can I ask somebody to get me a cup of coffee?
Here we got it.
Thank you.
We got it coming.
I'll give you a tip afterwards. Yes, please. She was converted by attending a meeting in her Black Baptist church led by some of the civil rights activists. They formed an acronym called COFU, I think it was. It involved a bridge group of SCLC, the SNCC, and another group. NAACP. And there was a meeting at her church in the evening, and I've forgotten who it was. I think it was James Bevel got up and began to preach on the signs of the times. Can't remember the biblical verses. She could. She had an unbelievable memory for where texts were in the Bible, although she only went to school for 7 months in her life. The upshot of this of the sermon was that now was the time to act. Now is the time to register to vote. Now, registering to vote was, in Mississippi, Sunflower County was, you're taking your life into your hands. Not only your life, but the livelihood of your family. Somebody else got up to speak. I've forgotten who it was. At the end of their talk, she's converted. She signs a paper with 17 other people saying that they're going to go down and register to vote on the following Friday. We get on the bus, a yellow school, yellow bus, which is not a school bus. It was a bus that took cotton pickers around. And they go into the county seat, and they're nervous as hell. And they get off the bus, led by Fannie Lou Hamer, who's been singing, "This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine," all along on the way to encourage them to do this. And she and another guy walk in because the registrar would only allow two at a time. And he says, okay, you got to take a test on the Constitution of Mississippi. She says, "I wasn't even aware of Mississippi in the Constitution." Clearly, they were going to fail. They were going to fail no matter how well they knew the Constitution of Mississippi. And they come out, and the others go in, and they all fail. They get on the bus, and they're riding back. They're stopped by a police car. And the police car has them all get off the bus, and has them all get back on the bus. And they find the driver because his bus is too yellow. It looks like a school bus. And they draw up a collection and pay the fine. As soon as she gets home, she learns that her boss, who she's worked for 18 years, whom she has sent cakes to when he was in the war, World War II, tells her to go down and reconsider. She says, I'm not. I didn't do that for you. I did it for me. And he's aware that the Klan is going to come after him if they hear that his people are trying to register to vote. So she's off the plantation. She's fired that very night. Her husband is fired that very night. She's got to leave the house that he owns. And all of her speeches are studded with scripture because she learned how to read, not in school, but she learned how to read at the Black Baptist Church that she went to. Now, she's down on the ministers because the ministers basically, she says, are the chicken-eating ministers because their hands are tied in terms of any kind of political action. But her whole understanding is biblically studied. If you read any of her speeches, the Bible comes up often more and more, and the hymns that she uses come up more and more. So I would say that faith-based and governmental action don't need to be, seem to me that don't need to be
in opposition. Yeah.
You know,
in opposition. Yeah.
That there's some way for them to be to combine in ways that don't violate church and state separation, but that can be practically usable for alleviating some of the problems that we have in society. And that's going to be a topic of the afternoon.
That's our topic after lunch. And Adele Banks, you'll get the last question before we do break for lunch. We're going to break a little early for lunch because we're going to come back in here. It says on your schedule one, we're going to come back in here at 12:45. So we're going to break a little earlier for lunch. So Adele, you'll take us into the break. Yes.
I noticed that you had the word docility in the end of your book title. I wonder if you could explain that forgiveness may or may not be a sign of being docile and how it might relate to the whole historic stigma and tension of the relationship between slave and slave master.
Well, that came from Rebellion. No. Rebellion and Docility goes back, the chapter goes back to my first book, Slave Religion.
Religion, your first book, okay.
That was purposely chosen as part of the binary that occupied...
Speaking to the mic.
Oh, yeah, that occupied the discussion during the, particularly during the Black Power period. I was teaching at Xavier University in New Orleans, and the issue became very alive as to, politically at the time, as to whether Christianity was a detriment to the struggle for Black liberation, or whether it was a spur to Black liberation. And so I decided I want to study that question. So I applied for admission to Yale's program in religious studies, and Sidney Ahlstrom, who was a major American religious historian, called me up and said, "We'd like for you to come." And so I went, and that became the topic of my dissertation. When I first mentioned it to several people, faculty members, they said, "Weren't they all Baptists and Methodists?" I said, "Well, the majority of them were, but it was more complicated than that." And so I took on this issue of how did religion, it's not only a black-white question, only an American question, this is a question that goes to the Marxist critique, you know, of religion, which has, you know, been applicable in Sicily and a wide range of other people with Gramsci. So my conclusion in that chapter is to say certainly there were times when, the notion of depending upon Jesus and upon salvation in another world was important. But that didn't necessarily mean that at another time in the slave's life, or when that incident arose, that he might engage in rebellious actions, such as attending a praise meeting that was forbidden by the master. That's a revolutionary act, because you're going to get 50 lashes if you're caught doing it. So you're praising Jesus, who the master thinks counsels slavery, but you're doing it in a way that relativizes the master's will. God's will takes precedent over the master's will. Now, that's not Denmark Vesey, or it's not Nat Turner, it's not Gabriel Prosser, it's not an outright plot to revolt, but it is a revolutionary action in terms of who's the most important source of value in my life? God, not the master.